This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's News Hour. This show is going to be one of the key shows that we do this year in that it reflects how we're at a key inflection point in our economy and in our markets, but especially politically as we head into the 2020 presidential elections, where some view the choices as being between socialism versus capitalism. And you're going to hear the president and his Democrat opponent offer two very different views as to which direction they want to take the country. Two completely distinctive views of how to run the economy economically. But there's a larger picture that overrides either view, and that's the country's mounting debt problem. Now, as of this program, the U.S. national debt is over $22 trillion, and the national deficit will hit $973 billion this year. We're now entering an era of trillion, if not multi-trillion dollar deficits. And those trillion dollar deficits are coming at a time of 3% economic growth. Now, that's the best in a decade, and unemployment is at a 50-year low. Tax revenues are rising because of a growing economy, but government spending is rising even faster at a rate of 5 to 6% per year. But here's a sobering statistic. By 2026, and this is according to the CBO, entitlements and interest on the debt will consume 100% of all government tax revenues. So where will the extra money come from to pay for the cost of running government or new entitlements that are being proffered, such as free college, free health care, or a guaranteed income for all? Well, our politicians and economists are telling us how this will all be paid for. It sounds modern, sophisticated, really a panacea for all politicians who love to make promises of free stuff to voters at election time. But here's the thing. Don't think this is just one particular political party. Folks, both sides subscribe to the theory, and it's called MMT, or modern monetary policy. It represents a pivotal point in our debt-burdened economy. In fact, it's the oldest trick in the book, and it's nothing new. We've seen it play out throughout human history with, well, disastrous results. It's called debt monetization, or basically printing money. So, Jim, explain the theory, how it works, and why politicians of both parties are advocating it, and also how it plays out, the consequences for the economy, investment markets, and for our investors.
It's being presented by both parties, Chris, and it's kind of like coming out of academia, and it's kind of like, wow, this is the latest, greatest new thinking. It's not new, as you pointed out. But let's get to the definition, because you're going to hear a lot more about this in the upcoming election and in the years ahead. MMT is sort of a macroeconomic theory that describes currency as a public monopoly for government and unemployment as the evidence that the currency monopolist can restrict the supply of the financial assets needed to pay taxes and satisfy savings. Now, MMT advocates argue that government should use fiscal policy to achieve full employment, creating new money to fund government spending. The primary risk is once the economy reaches full employment, which is where we're at currently because the unemployment rate is below 4%, is the possibility of inflation. Now, we've been in a multi-decade of what I call disinflationary forces. If you think back to 1981, we had close to 14% inflation. Interest rates on treasuries were 15.5%. Today, we have inflation below 2%. That's reported inflation. Some would question that. And we have interest rates below 2.4%. Now, according to MMT, don't worry if you print too much money and spend too much money because it can be controlled by raising taxes and issuing bonds to remove excess money from the system. And we'll talk economically later on why this doesn't work.
Well, it sounds like tax, spend, and inflate. There doesn't seem to be anything new or really modern about that, Jim.
It really isn't. It isn't new. When we tried this in the 1970s with disastrous results, you know, that's when I cut my teeth in the business, Chris. I came in towards the end of the 70s, beginning 1980. And gosh, when I got in the business, people were putting money in gold, real estate, oil. Oil had gone from just a couple bucks a barrel all the way to $40 a barrel. Inflation was running at over 14%. Interest rates were rising. But if you take a look at this, governments throughout history have sought to print money to pay for expenses that could not be paid for through the taxation or debt issuance. And there are several tenets to this theory that are somewhat controversial and subject to challenge in their assumptions and the probable outcomes. Let's talk about them. Number one, the government cannot default on its own currency. Number two, governments can pay for goods and services without resorting to taxation. Because as we know, just like a business, a government's business, they take in revenues, and those revenues are from taxes. And from those taxes or revenues, that allows or gives them the wherewithal to spend money, whether it's entitlements or running the government itself. Now, debt issuance, according to MMT, can be unlimited. In other words, that's why you don't hear people talking about the deficit anymore, even though we're going to be running a $1 trillion deficit, and the government now owes well over $22 trillion. Number three, money creation is limited by inflation, which accelerates once economic resources of the economy are utilized. I don't think there's much disagreement there. Number four, that inflation that may result can be controlled by taxation and bond issuance. In other words, if there's a lot of money in the banking system, all the government has to do is issue bonds and sop up the excess. And if the economy is overheating, you want to end it and stop the overheating, you just tax the heck out of people. And people forget, back in the 1970s, the top income tax rate is 70%. And surprise, surprise, what are you hearing in this election? You're hearing about raising tax rates back up to 70%. And number five, you do not need to compete, or the government doesn't need to compete with the private sector for savings through bond issuance. Now, many of these tenets challenge the mainstream economic view that government spending should be funded by taxes and debt issuance. However, its adherents are growing in number among the political class. It becomes basically a justification for spending money on whatever popular program a politician would like to implement or offer to voters to gain votes in an election. We are in a presidential election year, and both parties are going to say, if you elect me, I'm going to give you lots of stuff. Well, the question is, all that stuff, it's being presented to the voters. Well, it's free, but we could get somebody else to pay for it. The Trump administration is probably a good example of MMT in the start of it. Now, when President Trump started his administration, the economy was growing at an anemic rate, roughly about 2%. The unemployment rate was in the mid-upper 4% range. Today, it's below 4%. The economy's growing at 3%. So the Trump administration did something that we saw the Obama administration plus the Fed do in 2009. Now, in 2009, we were in the worst recession since 1974. The stock market was down about 58%. And Obama came in with the stimulus bill of a little over $1 trillion of spending. The Fed launched QE1 with 1.2. So the government in 2009 came up with a $2 trillion stimulus program because we were in a recession, a bear market. Trump came into office with the economy growing at 2%, not 10% unemployment as we had in 2009, but the unemployment rate was in the upper 4% range. He comes in with a $1.5 trillion tax stimulus and an additional $300 billion. So what made this unusual, and this is the beginning of MMT, is a $2 trillion spending stimulus program coming at the end of a business cycle. It is one reason the government will run a $1 trillion deficit this year, why the economy is growing at 3%, and the lowest unemployment rate in half a century. It's becoming popular, Chris, with both parties, and the Trump administration launched it.
Well, it is becoming popular with both parties, and I'm just wondering, how does this all play out, or maybe even fit in with the Fed monetary policy? It's been the main driver during this economic expansion. And then I'm also thinking about so much of what's happened to financial markets last year and this year are a good example of Fed policy impacting markets by sending stock markets, even most asset classes, plunging last fall with their hawkish stance and then reversing themselves this year. It's caused all the markets to soar in value.
Yeah, MMT is being proposed because QE is seen as having lost the war on inflation and economic stimulus, despite expanding its balance sheet from roughly about $760 billion to $4.6 trillion. Economic growth has been anemic. During the entire Obama administration, the economy grew at less than 2%. So along comes Trump, and he says, the heck with monetary policy, that's not working. We're going to use fiscal policy. And now we have 3% economic growth. The unemployment rate is below 4%. The failure of QE to create a sustainable inflation and avoid a disinflationary environment is leading to the belief that more extreme policy options are justifiable. So what is becoming clear is that traditional monetary policy is running out of options. Now, if you think of past economic cycles or Fed rate-raising cycles, the Fed was able in the last decade to raise the Fed funds rate to roughly about 5.5%. This time around, we only got to 2.5% and they just went on pause. So the Fed and the government itself is thinking, we need to think up or come up with something new, because what happens in the next downturn when we can no longer use interest rates effectively to stimulate borrowing? So the emphasis is now shifting away from monetary policy to direct intervention in economic affairs through fiscal policy, which we've seen with the Trump administration. So it's more likely we're going to see less independence at the Fed going forward as fiscal policy takes precedent. When I say less independence, everybody remembers what happened last year as the Fed was raising interest rates, the presidential tweets coming from President Trump saying, you know, he was against what the Fed was doing. And what the Fed was doing was counteracting fiscal policy. We just implemented a $2 trillion stimulus program because we wanted to get higher economic growth. Along comes the Fed and says, oh, we're going to slow this down by raising interest rates. So you had a lot of pressure coming from the president. And then, of course, when the markets reacted to the hawkishness, as we saw in the fourth quarter, all of a sudden the markets were down 20%. Oil prices fell 40. All of a sudden, the Fed said, whoa, when they backed off. And of course, we saw the pivot that began this year. So there is also the issue, as you brought up at the beginning, of this debt burden, which is only going to get bigger in the years. I mean, right now, folks, we're running a $1 trillion deficit with strong economic growth and the lowest unemployment. What would the deficits be if we actually get into a recession where unemployment goes up, tax revenues plummet, and government spending increases? So there are a lot of individuals that think that the era of central bank dominance over the economy that really began during the Volcker era is coming to an end. What is likely to replace it is fiscal policy acting with very little physical restraint. Notice, no one is talking about the fiscal deficit anymore, even though it's close to $1 trillion. When we were running $1.6 trillion in 2009, 10, and 11, that's all, for example, all Republicans talked about was the Obama deficits. Well, Trump comes into office. Here we are back at $1 trillion, but this time we're not in a recession. So both parties keep talking about spending massive amounts of money on new entitlements, military expansion, not to mention the growing burden of existing programs that will run out of money or need reform by 2026. Or 2035. By 2035, Social Security will have to be cut by 25%. There won't be the money there. Starting next year, Social Security will take in less money than it pays out in benefits. So all of this is taking place, and they're talking about spending even more money. And the question is, how are they going to pay for it? Where's the money going to come from?
You know, Jim, what's not very clear to me, though, why when the Fed expanded its balance sheet at nearly fivefold, we never got hyperinflation, and so many predicted that that's exactly what would occur.
The reason that we never saw the big inflation when the Fed expanded its balance sheet, much of the money the Fed created to buy all of those mortgages and bonds in an effort to drive down interest rates ended up on the Fed's balance sheet instead of credit being expanded through the banking system, finding its way into the real economy. Now, we had inflation, but that inflation took place in financial assets with stock prices up over 300%. Earnings improved when the economy recovered, but not by the rate that would justify today's stock prices. Earnings rose, but they rose through massive stock buyback programs, in many cases, which were financed through corporate debt expansion. So when you're financing it through the debt markets, it's a little bit different when it's run through the banking system, which has a money multiplier and expands the money supply, and you get inflation. Why did the stock market go up as much as it did? It's because interest rates fell, PE multiples rose, as investors were willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. So when money is created, it has several outlets. It can go into goods and services, driving up prices as it did in the 70s, or let's say into real estate as it did in the last decade, or it can do what it did in this decade, which is go into financial assets as it has done, and it gives us the bull market in the two that preceded it.
Jim, I want to go ahead and play a clip from an interview you did just a couple of years ago from the author of Dying of Money.
You know, something that you talk about in your book, which we're seeing play out today, is every burst of monetary inflation was followed by a stock market rise and boom with prosperity. Every contraction by a stock market fall and recession. We saw, for example, the boom of the late 90s followed by a contraction and a stock market fall. That was followed by more money printing, and we got another stock market boom and a real estate boom. Then we got a crash in the market again, as well as in real estate. Let's talk about those reservoirs of inflation that you talk so much about in your book, money wealth being one of them and the stock market being another one.
Well, it's true that those reservoirs are very serious. I think the largest one is the debt market, which is tying up a great deal of money right now. That's what I meant earlier when I mentioned the fact that interest rates are practically zero. And the Fed has been pumping out money at a great rate for the last several years.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
But if the government takes over more of the economy, Jim, and whether that's through regulation or fiscal policy, along with monetary policy, don't you think that we're moving further away from free markets? I mean, what we call capitalism?
You know, one of the central assumptions of MMT is that the government knows best how to run the economy, make investment decisions, and how money should be spent and capital allocated. Now, the politicians and the academics who support them believe in a planned economy, in other words, a centrally planned economy by government. It will, but in the essential debate between both parties in this presidential election, and that's what it's going to be about. The Democrats are proposing socialist policies, and Trump will defend a limited form of capitalism. For it is Trump, initially, who initiated MMT with this massive fiscal policy spending program coming at the end of the business cycle, which is why this business expansion has lasted this long. Chris, in my nearly four decades in this business, I have never seen a president in Congress enact a major stimulus program coming at the end of a business cycle. That's what makes this so unique. It normally comes after a recession. Think 2009, think 2001 with President Bush, think 1992 with President Clinton, think Ronald Reagan in 1981. So the massive stimulus in monetary programs come in the midst of a recession as the economy is trying to recover, not at the end of the business cycle when the economy is still growing.
But wouldn't you say in the end, Jim, that, I mean, aren't these policies inflationary?
MMT comes with an inflationary tailwind behind it, no doubt about it. I mean, the politicians and the academics will point to the fact that taxes can be used to cool down inflation if the economy overheats. They basically say, hey, don't worry, we're spending a lot of money, and I know we're running trillion-dollar deficits, but hey, if inflation rises, unlike the Fed raising interest rates, we'll just raise taxes. But in reality, this hardly happens. Can you imagine a politician proposing, although there are some right now, proposing major taxes to slow down the economy ahead of an election? Notice what they're saying. We're going to raise taxes because we're going to give you a lot of free stuff. They're not saying we're going to raise taxes to slow down the economy, because simply that doesn't fly. So even President Obama, when he took office, waited to 2012 after he was reelected before they put into place the higher tax rates. Other assumptions being made here is that somehow government can fine-tune the economy with precision. Well, the best example I can give you why that will not work is the Fed itself. The Fed has tried to do the same thing with the raising and lowering of interest rates, and unfortunately, it has failed. 11 out of the last 12 rate-raising cycles have ended up in a bear market and a recession. Does anyone listening to this program really believe politicians running for re-election will make the hard decisions necessary to stop either inflation by slowing the economy and raising the unemployment rate? You could have just imagined what that would look like. Hi, my fellow voters, vote for me because I'm going to raise your taxes, slow the economy, and put you out of jobs. I don't think that's going to fly. So nonetheless, MMT is now being espoused by both parties as the new economic paradigm in miracle theory to make the economy grow by greater government control over the economic dynamics. As it was stated in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing really new under the sun. This has all been tried before with disastrous results. Just look at Venezuela today. In a nutshell, MMT is nothing more than central bank financing of government deficits. The adherents of MMT will tell you, hey, don't worry about the inflationary consequences of MMT. It can be controlled by government through the mechanisms of taxation, which can be used to either dampen or stimulate economic demand while being used to redistribute income from producers to consumers. Now, MMT proponents argue MMT is superior to stimulating or dampening economic activity. In other words, raising and lower taxes works better than raising and lower interest rates. They also believe that inflation comes from the existence of monopolies, what we call excessive pricing power. Is it not surprising in this election, 2020 candidates are calling for the breakup of many of the FANG stocks, from Google, Microsoft, Amazon to Facebook? They're all calling, if they're elected, they are going to break up those monopolies, kind of like what Teddy Roosevelt did to the Standard Oil monopoly back in the early part of the 20th century.
And you really do hear a push for that. That would definitely be consequential. And I hate to keep bringing this up, Jim, but I want to go back to this. What about our growing debt, the deficits issues? Doesn't that create a problem for implementing MMT?
Well, the critical caveat of MMT is that a government has no limitations if it can borrow as much as it wants, if it's not owed to other nations or in other currencies. The problem that you have in Venezuela today, or Argentina, or Turkey, is that their debt is often denominated in other currencies. Now, they'll cite Japan as an example that has a high debt-to-GDP ratio, but Japan's debt is mainly owned by Japan, not foreign investors. Now, let's take our current situation. Currently, of the $22.3 trillion that the U.S. owes, about a third of that debt is owned by foreigners, with China and Japan the largest foreign owners. The Fed owns $2.4 trillion in treasuries. Investors own roughly about $7 trillion. The U.S. Trust Fund owns about roughly $6 trillion. That's money that Social Security, the government has borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund and other trust funds. And foreigners own the balance of roughly over $6 trillion. Now, in order to avoid a crisis, as we had in the late 70s, the Fed would have to step up its bond buying program considerably to avoid a dollar or a debt crisis. The other issue, once again, will politicians be any smarter than the Fed in knowing when to stimulate and dampen the economy? Now, if the Fed never got it right in the last, let's say, 12 economic cycles, 11 of them ending up in recession, what makes anyone here think the illiterate politicians are any smarter? All we can do is look at history over several millenniums. And Chris, this is nothing new. It's nothing more than inflating the debt, allowing for a runaway government spending paid for through inflating and debasing the currency. This is a case of when money dies, something I discussed in my interview with Ronald Marks.
Yeah, because one of the things you talk about in your book is a man with money can spend it on two principal kinds of things. One kind is current goods and services, which adds to GDP. The second kind is land, property, stocks, and mortgages, which corresponds to national wealth. At any given time, there are two distinct money supplies and two distinct velocities of money. Let's talk about that.
I may be overstating the separation when I say two distinct money supplies, but what I mean is that there are two separate parts of the money supply which are being used in these two different markets. And I suppose there is a velocity of money in the capital markets and a different velocity of money in goods and services. The outpouring of inflated money usually goes into the capital markets first, creating rising markets and eventually inflation in that market. And then it moves into goods and services where it causes the inflation that's really painful.
There's something I want to do here, Chris, and kind of stop. There are several books I would recommend to our readers. I used to talk about them a lot in the last decade when we were inflating, which was an inflationary decade. Now, there are three of them I would recommend. Now, these were books that were published a long time ago, so you're going to have to search for them. I was looking last night on Amazon. They're available out there, used and new. The first one is the one that we just played a couple of quotes, and we got a real surprise for you coming up after this broadcast. The first one is called Dying of Money, Lessons of the Great German and American Inflation by Genzo Parsons. The second is When Money Dies, The Nightmare of the Weimar Republic by Adam Ferguson. Now, both authors I had the privilege of interviewing. The third one is The Economics of Inflation by Constantino Bresciani-Tarroni. Now, if you want to understand what lies ahead of us the next decade, these books will give you a firm understanding of the inflationary consequences of MMT. And for those of you who lean more towards the scholarly, and let's say the academic side, I would strongly recommend Capitalism by George Riesman, who is a professor of economics at Pepperdine University. One of the things that you will learn from reading these books is that inflation leads to large budget deficits. As inflation rises, as you would expect, government expenditures start to rise faster than tax revenues, which fall behind with a lag. The result is that deficits get even larger. All great inflations in the past have been preceded by high budget deficits, as we are now starting to see in a growing U.S. economy and low unemployment in 50 years, probably the lowest we've seen in half a century. Yet we're looking at $1 trillion deficits. What are those deficits going to look like during the next downturn and when MMT powers up with massive fiscal spending to bring us out of the next recession?
And I want to alert our listeners to a special segment of today's show. Following this big picture segment, we're going to replay an interview that Jim did with Ronald Marks, a.k.a. Genzo Parsons. This was back in 2013, and as Jim's indicating, it's relevant today, if not more so, as the government, both parties, move toward MMT.
You know, listeners to this program will probably recall one of my favorite passages from Dying of Money to describe the inflationary cycle, or what we will be now calling MMT. And it goes somewhat like this, and I'm reading this from page 71 of the book. And it goes, everyone loves an early inflation. The effects at the beginning of an inflation are all good. There's steepened money expansion, rising government spending, increased government budget deficits, a booming stock market, and a spectacular general prosperity, all in the midst of a temporarily stable prices. Everyone benefits and no one pays. That is the early part of the cycle. In the latter inflation, on the other hand, the effects are all bad. The government may steadily increase the money inflation in order to stave off the latter effects. But the latter effects patiently wait. In the terminal inflation phase, there is faltering prosperity, tightness of money, falling stock prices, rising taxes, and still even larger government deficits, and still soaring money expansion, but now accompanied by soaring prices and the ineffectiveness of all traditional remedies. Everyone pays, no one benefits. That is the full cycle of every inflation. The United States, by 1968, had not yet seen anything but the upslope of the cycle. How true and prescient those words were. This book was written in 1974. By 1971, the U.S. stopped gold backing of the U.S. currency, and the latter effects, the rise of inflation, was what took effect. Really, you began to see this in the Carter administration to the point where Paul Volcker had to come back. They called it the Saturday Night Massacre, where he raised the federal funds rate by 3% overnight on a weekend. You can imagine what would happen if Powell was to do that today. But those were very prescient words. The problem with all great inflations is that government decides how much to spend. They decide when to stop spending or to reduce spending, especially after full employment is reached, as it has now. It is something nobody knows when enough of spending is enough. It is something no one knows when enough spending is enough, as if it could ever be known in advance. Think of the Fed and its monetary policy. They never know, except for through hindsight, that they raised interest rates too much. A good example is 2018. The Fed started out, they were going to raise rates 3 times. They ended up raising them 4 times, and they got very aggressive last fall, only to backtrack beginning this year. So even then, it's the government that decides when to raise or lower taxes in response to cooling or overheating the economy. Here's what you're going to see, just as we saw in the 70s. The central bank independence dies. It's merely an appendage of government to do the government's bidding by printing money to buy the government debt. Nor can you as an investor count on any politician to do what is right other than to think of his or her own reelection.
And Jim, let's talk for a moment about if we can return to the inflation factor. Why didn't we see it reflected in the economy with all the Fed's QE?
You know, the main reason is that all of that QE never got transmitted into the economy through credit expansion used to expand investment or buy goods and services. One of the reasons why you're seeing, QE really didn't work. That's why we need to have fiscal policy, which is more direct. Debt was issued, but not through bank credit, which multiplies the money factor. Instead, it was done through the bond market with corporations, for example, issuing bonds to buy back their stock to the tune of almost $500 billion a year. A lot of the money created by QE went into the government bond market and remained as government reserves held at the Fed rather than finding its way into the economy through, let's say, the expansion of lending through the banking system. Now, the transmitter of inflation under MMT will not be the banking system. It'll be government. The government will simply spend the money, so it'll flow directly into the economy, and the Fed will simply print money and buy the debt issued by the government to pay for that spending. And here's how it works. Let me give you a simplified example. Let's take GDP. Let's say in our hypothetical GDP, we make 1 million widgets a year that sell at $1. So GDP is $1 million. Money in the economy is about $1 million, equaling the amount used to pay for those widgets. Now, let's say the government comes in and they say, we want to stimulate the economy. They're going to increase the money supply through spending and debt issuance, so it goes to 2 million. However, the economy is still producing the same 1 million widgets, but now those widgets cost $2 instead of $1. Now, that's probably an oversimplification of inflation, which is simply more money changing the same supply of goods in services, so the cost of those goods and services has to rise. Unfortunately, every generation or every other generation, we make the same mistake in thinking we can get something for nothing, or somewhere out there, there's a free lunch. The trick of free money has been tried since ancient times. Pharaohs, Roman emperors, kings, to more recently prime ministers or American presidents. However, the results are the same, the debasement of currency. And I think of that quote by George Santayana, more famous quote, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Now, Winston Churchill took that a little step further, changed it, and he made a speech in 1948 to the House of Commons when he said, "Those who failed to learn from history are condemned to repeat it."
Well, my final question, which I usually have at the end of any big picture, what does this mean for investors?
You know, we're at least in my opinion, a key inflection point in economics, a pivotal point moving from what I call a disinflationary era, where we've been probably since 1981, to an era that will be inflationary. To what extent, Chris, we simply don't know at this time. But the long-run bull market in financial assets, I believe, is coming to an end. The next phase of investing will favor, much like it did in the 70s, real assets as the last decade did. Think gold, think energy, think industrials, think real estate, think farmland, commodities, as Dave Morgan and I talked about in the first hour. All this high-tech stuff we have, whether it's solar panels, electric cars, cell phones, tablets, all of it takes raw minerals, whether it's copper, silver. It takes raw materials to make this stuff. So the price of real goods hold their value, and companies that can raise prices is going to be even more important. If you are a bond or fixed income investor, you're going to want to own laddered bonds with maturities that roll over and mature as interest rates begin their inexorable rise.
Well, folks, we're going to be covering more of this subject in the months ahead, even into next year's presidential election. The leaders of both parties propose new spending programs, and they're going to do everything they can to avoid disclosing how it's going to be paid. But stay tuned for a Financial Sense special interview that we're going to do now as we play Jim's interview with the real Jens O. Parsons, or Ronald Marks. Before we play that interview, tell our listeners, Jim, the story about the interview and the book.
Yeah, this was kind of one of the highlights in my broadcast career. I began studying Austrian economics in the late 90s because, you know, I was raised in graduate school on Keynesian economics, and we saw it fail in the 70s. So researching inflation and its causes led me to get into, for example, gold, energy, emerging market, and commodities as primary investments in the last decade. Now, I came across three books. I mentioned after reading Capitalism by George Riesman, in the course of that research, I learned that Jens O. Parsons was really a nom de plume used by a well-known lawyer and partner in a prestigious law firm. He wrote the book in 1974. We had just gone off the gold standard, and the book was very critical of the economic policies being pursued by then-President Nixon and also the Arthur Burns Fed. And of course, if you're a partner at a prestigious law firm, you don't want your name out there being critical of government. But so many of the things that Parson wrote about, including the quote I read here on the air, unfolded exactly as he said they would. So he's long since retired, but I got a hold of his son, who arranged the interview, which you're about to hear. And I'm happy to say the book was reprinted in paperback form back in March of 2011. The original book was written in 1974, way ahead of its time. The book out there, it's somewhat pricey, prices ranging from $46 to $149. When I bought my original copy, it was the original 1974 edition. I think I paid $300 for it. As I reminded Ronald Marks, his inflation forecast came true, and it was reflected in the price of his book. So I highly recommend finding a copy or maybe looking at your library. I hope you enjoyed listening to my interview, which was one of my favorite interviews of my broadcast career. That's coming up next.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
After World War I, the major powers went through a great recession. But unlike the power that was defeated, things were different in Germany. In 1920 and 1921, Germany had enjoyed a remarkable prosperity, envied by the rest of the world. Prices were steady, business was humming, and everyone was working. The stock market was skyrocketing. The Germans were swimming in easy money. Within a year, they were drowning in it. Until it was all over, no one seemed to notice any connection between the earlier false boom and the latter inflationary bust. Fast forward to the 21st century today, and we have central banks around the globe printing money. Will we see inflation again? Well, we're going to be talking about that today with my special guest, Genzo Parsons. Now, you've heard me talk about dying of money over the years, and I've often referred to the author as Genzo Parsons. His real name is Ronald Marks, and he joins me on the program today. Mr. Marks, it's great to be speaking with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Before we get into your book, I want to ask you, why did you choose a nom de plume such as Genzo Parsons when you wrote the book, rather than using your name?
Well, I was a practicing lawyer at the time. This was in the middle 60s. And we had a number of clients who were the hot stocks of the period. And I had some bad comments to make about that period in U.S. economic history. And I didn't want to offend any clients. So I published it under an assumed name.
You have written, in my opinion, one of the best books I have ever read on inflation and how it works. Given your law background, how did you acquire the insights into the process of inflation and how it works its way through the economy?
Well, it's a process of self-education. I had never had an economics course, which I think was a bit of an advantage because I hadn't been imbued with some of those wrong ideas that economics was teaching. But I saw the inflation starting to happen in the middle 60s, and I wanted to see what was the cause of this. So I conceived of the idea that I have in the book of tracing inflation to the quantity of money times its velocity divided by the amount of assets to be paid for by the money. And before I discovered that that theory had already been created by some economists who were not the orthodox economists, but mavericks of a sort.
Who were those economists?
Well, Irving Fisher was one. He was a very prominent American economist and had written on the subject back at around the turn of the century. This is before World War I.
You know, one of the things I learned in your book, the ability of savers in Germany to hold marks enabled the government to mask the underlying effects of inflation. This storage factor of investors saving marks kept those marks from being dumped immediately into the market. In many ways, just like today, where you have Americans that are holding treasuries or buying treasury bonds, a lot of money has gone into the bond funds. Do you see a lot of similarities between, let's say, what happened in Germany and what's happening today?
Well, very much so. In fact, I think it's even worse now than it was in Germany. I did some calculations on the present state of affairs. The money supply has increased by 4.85 since the end of 1979, and prices have only increased by 2.32 times, which means that there's a latent inflation of about 109% by these calculations. That inflated money is mainly, I would say, in the debt markets, because you found that even federal debt securities are pretty close to 0% interest, which is very contrasting to the situation in the past when outbreaks of inflation were occurring. Interest rates went higher than 10%, for instance. So I think that's where the money is that has been pumped out. And the question is when that money starts to come back from debt securities into goods.
You know, this is something, I guess, people here in the United States have had a tough time understanding. The one thing that the U.S. has as an advantage is we're the world's reserve currency. Does that give us a little bit more leeway, in your opinion, versus, let's say, a country like Argentina?
I don't think it gives you more leeway. I think it gives you less, because those foreign holders of dollars are the potential for an outburst of inflation. If they lose faith in the dollar, that's what will happen. This happened with Germany, too. The German mark was greatly respected at the time, and a great many marks were held by overseas holders, including Americans. And when the inflation started to get rolling, all of that foreign money came into Germany looking for things to buy, and that compounded the inflation instead of reducing it.
You talked about, in your book, a quick and clean inflation, which destroys paper wealth like an amputation, is often less vicious than a surprised and protracted inflation. Why is that, in your opinion?
Well, the longer inflation drags on, the more collateral damage it causes to the economy. Whereas if, for instance, we were to raise all our prices by 100% overnight, there wouldn't be that prolonged pain being inflicted on us. Of course, that isn't the way that inflation has ever ended, so it's really kind of hypothetical.
You know, something that you talk about in your book, which we're seeing play out today, is every burst of monetary inflation was followed by a stock market rise and boom with prosperity. Every contraction by a stock market fall and recession. We saw, for example, the boom of the late 90s followed by a contraction and a stock market fall. That was followed by more money printing, and we got another stock market boom and a real estate boom. Then we got a crash in the market again, as well as in real estate. Let's talk about those reservoirs of inflation that you talk so much about in your book, money wealth being one of them and the stock market being another one.
Well, it's true that those reservoirs are very serious. I think the largest one is the debt market, which is tying up a great deal of money right now. That's what I meant earlier when I mentioned the fact that interest rates are practically zero, and the Fed has been pumping out money at a great rate for the last several years.
One of the quotes that I often refer to in your book, and in fact, it's one of my favorites, but it describes the inflation process. I want to read it. My listeners will know it by heart because I often quote it. Everyone loves an early inflation. The effects at the beginning of an inflation are all good. There's steep in money expansion, rising government spending, increased government budget deficits, and booming stock markets, and a spectacular general prosperity, all in the midst of temporary stable prices. Everyone benefits and no one pays. That's the early part of the cycle. In the latter inflation, on the other hand, the effects are all bad. The government may steadily increase the money inflation in order to stave off the latter effects, but the latter effects patiently wait. And I think about, Mr. Marks, the last decade where we came out of the tech bubble and the Fed lowered the federal funds rate, the money supply increased, we had general prosperity, the economy took off along with the market and real estate. But then by the time we got to 2006 and 2007, inflation had risen to 5%. Interest rates were rising as the Fed raised the federal funds rate. And eventually, we know what happened. They call it the Great Recession. Tax revenues fell. Money printing increased. Stock prices fell along with real estate. Let's talk about that, because I think that's what people forget. When the Fed starts to increase the money supply, lower interest rates, eventually it creates a wealth effect. And we see it in the stock market. We see it even in the bond market with lower interest rates and rising bond prices. But it all comes to an end, as all inflations have in history.
Well, that is certainly true. In this cycle, the prices have not risen anywhere near as much as the money supply has, so that we have some of the effects of the deflation. We don't have a money deflation, but we have a lot of stored up inflation that's still waiting to happen.
And that's money wealth, which is the debt markets. And several of the technicians I've had on the program are predicting that at some point, after 5 or 6 years of 0% interest rates, investors are going to start to wake up to the fact that their money doesn't buy the same goods and services. and also that the rate of return is not commensurate with the rate of inflation. Hasn't quite happened yet, but it's a storage that is a potential there. You also talk in your book about when inflation starts to heat up. I can remember President Carter saying that inflation is caused by strange and mysterious forces. Sometimes the government comes up with culprits and scapegoats. It's businesses raising prices, greedy oil companies or unions trying to raise wages. But let's talk about the culprits and the scapegoats, which are never mentioned, the fact that it's money creation itself, because all inflation is a monetary event.
Right.
Can you talk about the quantity theory of money formulating your thesis on inflation?
Well, the quantity theory of money is simply that prices are determined by the quantity of money multiplied by its rate of spending. The rate of spending is about 50 times a year in the United States. The quantity times velocity has been divided by the supply of values, which are going to be transferred by means of money. That supply of values includes the gross national product, but it also includes all the existing assets, stocks and bonds and real estate and all those assets which are available to sell and can be sold. That, by the way, is one of the differences that my analysis takes from Milton Friedman, for instance, who compared the money supply with just the gross national product. And that misses a big reservoir of inflationary potential is in the markets for capital assets.
You know, you talk about three variables that are at work in inflation. You have the money supply, and then you have money velocity, how quickly it turns over, and then, of course, the supply of real values or goods. And you talk about in the early stages of inflation, quantity leads. The money supply increases. Eventually, velocity follows. And one thing that we've seen with the Fed's expansion of its balance sheet coming out of the Great Recession, we've seen an increase in the money supply, but we have yet to see the velocity. Is that because, Mr. Marks, in your opinion, a lot of that money that could be turned into velocity is waiting in reservoirs of inflation, like in the stock market or the bond market?
I'm not sure the velocity has decreased. I think if you were to look at the quantity increase multiplied by velocity, you'd find that there's a lot more purchasing power circulating around. And so far, it has remained in the investment markets instead of the markets for goods and services. So I think the latent inflation is in the capital markets rather than in decreased velocity or anything like that.
Yeah, because one of the things you talk about in your book is a man with money can spend it on two principal kinds of things. One kind is current goods and services, which adds to GDP. The second kind is land, property, stocks, and mortgages, which corresponds to national wealth. At any given time, there are two distinct money supplies and two distinct velocities of money. Let's talk about that.
I may be overstating the separation when I say two distinct money supplies. But what I mean is that there are two separate parts of the money supply which are being used in these two different markets. And I suppose there is a velocity of money in the capital markets and a different velocity of money in goods and services. The outpouring of inflated money usually goes into the capital markets first, creating rising markets and eventually inflation in that market. And then it moves into goods and services where it causes the inflation that's really painful.
Could that be something that the Fed is often referring to as the wealth effect? In other words, as money goes into an asset market, whether it was real estate in the last decade or currently stock prices, you know, people feel wealthier. They look at their 401k statements and they see that the stock market is going up. They see that their housing prices are starting to rise. And when they feel wealthier, they're more inclined to go out and spend that money. So eventually, when they start to spend it, it gets into the real economy. Is that the sequence?
I don't know whether it's a psychological feeling on the part of the people with the money. I think it's more of a mechanical process. The money just turns over kind of spontaneously. When a person has it, he's ready to spend it.
In the capital markets, as you talk about, which is a principal repository of inflation, my opinion, Mr. Marks, that's the good aspects of inflation when you see stock prices go up, bond prices go up. But I take a look, as you made reference to interest rates today. I mean, if you're a saver and put your money in treasury bills, a one-year treasury bill is about 0.1%. If you were in two-year treasury notes, you would get less than 0.3%. That doesn't even cover inflation by a wide margin. In your book, you talk about this money wealth, and Keynes talked about money wealth was the force to be stripped of. Let's talk about money wealth. When does it rise and basically rebel? Because at some point it does. And when it does so silently, as you talk about so eloquently in your book. It doesn't go out in the streets and protest like Occupy Wall Street. It just simply begins to withdraw and put the money elsewhere.
Right. The inflation of the money supply, as I said, it shows up earliest in the capital markets and then moves into the goods markets. The inflation we've been seeing recently has lowered the interest rates to practically zero, which is an enormous inflation of the value of the asset. I think it's only a matter of time before a reaction will set in, moving a good part of this purchasing power from capital markets into goods. It's a little hard to see that happening when we have a semi-recessionary condition in the goods markets, which is something that hasn't usually happened in an inflation. In other words, inflation tends to stimulate those markets rather than depress them. So it's a little hard to guess when the movement will occur, but in the end, it seems almost certain that it has to occur. Movement of money purchasing power from capital markets to goods and services.
Yeah, in your book, you talk about the inflationary assault on money wealth succeeds quite nicely for a time, but only until money wealth finds that it can erect a convenient and complete defense by simply abolishing fixed interest. When this takes place, the holders of money wealth express their revolt by the simple act of getting rid of their money and money wealth and declining to hold it in the future any longer than necessary to get rid of it. They do not fly flags or demonstrate in the streets or express their revolt. They simply get rid of their money. And all of those reservoirs, well, sometimes that's where the money goes, whether it goes into goods, real estate, or other type things. What about the role, Mr. Marx, of taxes? Money inflation operates on both the tax side and the distribution side, a valve which moves money wealth directly from creditors who saved and held capital to debtors who spent and consumed. For example, today, if you are a debtor, you can go out, you can refinance your house, you can get some of the lowest mortgage rates that I have seen in half a century. On the other hand, if you were diligently saving your money for retirement and you're retired trying to live off your savings in effect have been destroyed because you can't get a return. I mean, 5 years ago, had you had $1 million, I could have invested it in two-year treasury notes at 5%. You would have got a monthly income of, let's say, $4,000. If I was to invest it in two-year treasury notes today, you'd be lucky to get a monthly income of $200. So in this process, it has destroyed the returns for savers. If you're a debtor, you're making out like a bandit. If you're a saver, you're being robbed.
Right. As I say in the book, the inflation tax on dollar capital is the key element in the government's use of inflation as an active policy. Inflation tax draws heavily on the holders of money wealth and distributes to the people who benefit from the inflation, that is, consumers mainly. As I say in the book, the way to substitute for the inflation tax would be a capital tax in form. 2-3% tax on capital could substitute for the inflation financing that the government is depending on.
Is this, in some effect, what we've done since the beginning of the year? For example, the tax on capital gains was raised to 20%. There's an additional Obamacare tax of 3.8, so you're at almost 24% on capital gains. And recently, the state of Michigan and Illinois has now raised an estate tax on wealth of 10% on wealth over $1 million. So are we beginning to see the signs of this?
I guess I would comment on a couple of those taxes. The Michigan tax that you cited seems to be much too heavy. The most you could collect in a capital tax is 1-2%.
Because you would almost expect at some point if taxes got too high, I know I see this even with my own clients, they are less inclined to take capital gains. If they have a gain in real estate or they have a gain in stock, they just soon sit on it and allow the stock to appreciate rather than, let's say, take those gains and pay the taxes where, like in my own state of California, where the taxes can be 13.3%. You add that to almost 24%, you're talking about 37% or almost 40% of your gain, which gets rather high.
You may have noticed that one of the things I proposed in rationalizing the tax system was to index the basis for the capital asset and then tax the gain at ordinary income rates. I think that would be a useful way to increase the yield while at the same time making more sense. In other words, when we tax capital gains on the nominal gain, to some extent you're taxing the return of capital. If the value of the asset has increased with inflation, you're taxing the inflation the way we do it now. If we were to tax real gain at ordinary income rates, it might be a draw as far as tax revenue goes, but it would make more sense so that people with long-term holdings would not be penalized when they have to sell it with a gain that's not real.
You know, going back to your book, when you wrote it, which was in the early 70s, you predicted that the double-digit inflation would eventually end. How did you see that?
What I saw ending it was that prices would catch up with the increased money supply at a certain point. And I must say, I have to take credit for predicting that correctly because the double-digit inflation did slow down to the same speed as the money creation when that latent inflation of about 20-odd percent had been worked off by rising prices. Prices rising faster than money supply was rising. And that occurred in, what, 74, I guess.
Now, when you began writing this book, I know you did it over a period of time. In the beginning, you decided to self-publish the book. Why was that?
Well, I made a couple of abortive efforts to get a publisher. I asked the regular publishers if they were interested in it, and nobody was. So I said, well, all right, I'll publish it myself. I don't think they could see the strength of the argument I was making about what the money supply was doing. So I tried it myself.
Well, I'm glad to see that. A final question is, you've seen this inflationary process play out over time. Looking at what has unfolded over the last decade, if you were to write your book today, what would you change or what would you add to it?
I guess what I would add to it is to try to analyze the comparative rates of money and price inflation since 78. And in many ways, the experience in 78 is similar to what had occurred prior to 74, the much greater increase in money than prices to date, which it doesn't seem to show a strong tendency to liquidate itself, but it's there. And I would have to say that in all probability, it will liquidate itself at some point by a higher rate of price inflation than money expansion.
As you take a look at what we've done and what the Fed's doing now, do you expect to see higher rates of inflation going forward?
Yes, I do. Very much higher.
In the area like the 70s, where I think when I got in this business, could we see double-digit inflation again?
I don't see any reason why not. The money support for that double-digit inflation is there. The only thing that stands in the way is that business isn't good enough for everybody to feel ready to raise its prices. I don't know exactly why that is, but it is.
Well, speaking of inflation, Mr. Marks, I have an original copy of your book, which on the cover says $9.95. I paid $300 for it, so saw a little bit of inflation, and I'm just looking at Amazon. Your book was released and reprinted again, and on the hardcover, it's going for $189 and almost $100 used. So I think investing in your book has been one of the great investments of my life. Well, listen, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, and I can't tell you how much I admire the work that you've done. I've learned a great deal from it. When I take a look at events with central bankers around the world, and I keep referring back to your book, as I mentioned earlier as we began this interview, it's one of the best books I've ever read on inflation. And Mr. Marks, I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you for your thoughts about it, and I wish you well.
Well, thank you very much, and I wish you well. Godspeed. Well, that completes my interview with Ronald Marks. Once again, his nom de plume was Jens O. Parsons. And I'll tell you, investing in his book has been a great investment. I bought the book. It was re-released back in 2011. And if you can get them, pick them up while you can now, because they won't be available for very much longer. I'm just looking at Amazon now, and the supply, there are 13 new copies left and 7 used, so there are only 20 copies left of this book. And believe me, when you read it, it will be well worth the buy, because there is no finer book on the inflationary process than Dying of Money.
So, Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Chris, I've been out of the office for 2 weeks. I have no clue. It's up to you. No. Coming up in the weeks ahead, we are just about out of corporate earnings season. We've got a Fed meeting coming up here. Nobody expects the Fed to change much of anything. I think all eyes will be on this trade bill. Everybody knows that sooner or later they're going to have to come to some agreement, because the last thing we want is 25% tariffs to start kicking in. It's already hurting with the Chinese response to our buying agricultural commodities. Trump has pledged to take some of the money from tariffs to buy goods from farmers. But I would say the trade thing is probably one of the key things to look at. We have tensions building up in the Middle East, and the possibility, as we discussed previously, we're building up tensions that could possibly lead to a Middle East war. So those things will be keeping an eye out in the weeks and days ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.